This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
Give me a question on Buzz. Send me a Buzz. On Hive, sorry. On Buzz. Whatever.
You got too close to the sun.
Wyvern or dragon?
All right.
We picked a good episode to have three Australians on because Thanksgiving just means nothing to us.
And I know it's a rough watch, but he loved it.
How does this relate to a plushie?
I'm getting there. This is an anecdote, not a segue, all right?
Cool story, Ben. Anyway.
I don't know if I had to, but I certainly didn't.
Okay, all right, moving along.
It was so not important that I don't want to repeat it.
All that and more right now.
What? I have something to say that's not remotely important.
Okay, good.
I bought this jacket at an op shop yesterday. Yep. Very excited about it. For our Americans, that is a thrift store. It is short for opportunity shop. And I was happy. This pocket, look, I checked the pocket. Good, real pocket. Wonderful. And then I got home and the other pocket has inexplicably, it's... Why would fake pocket?
Yeah. To get juice. You are the exact customer fooled by the one real pocket.
They'll only check the right pocket, they said. And it's like officially sewn shut. It's like there is a pocket that they've just sewn shut. It's very upsetting.
That is upsetting. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one D&D podcast in all the realms of Kryn, all the kingdoms of Kryn. I'm actually not that down on my Kryn lore, but that's okay. I've brought in some experts this week to help me. My name is Ben Byrne, and I'm joined, as always, by Dale Kingsmill and special guest Amy Dallin from D&D Beyond Wizards of the Coast. Where are you from? Where do you hail from? Those places?
Those are the actual places, which is, okay, it's been like 6 months and it's still hard to be like, that's true. Those are true words.
Yes.
Those are the places that I hail from, formerly of Geek and Sundry, along with Dale and many of our friends and other parts of the nerd internet, but now happily at the coast and officially, I guess, a wizard. It hasn't worn off.
That's how it works.
Have you got your pointy hat yet and your wand or has an owl delivered?
I may have acquired my own pointy hat. As soon as I found out, you know, just they haven't taken it away. So I think it's official as long as I say it's the official hat.
That's fair. Yeah, that's how things work. Also joining us, Phil Beckwith, project manager from Ghostfire Gaming. Woo! Welcome, Phil, to the podcast. Phil, I've got a question for you. This comes from Jeremy, who buzzed me on Hive using the little question feature, who wants
just
to know.
Just for the record, for people who don't know, Ben is trying to coin the term buzzed as Hive as a social platform is picking up speed.
Is picking up. It feels so great. It's so much better than Mastodon. Mastodon was like, what is this place? This is weird. I feel alone here. Whereas Hive is just popping off. Like there's so many, there's new folks joining every day. It's great. Anyway, Jeremy wants to ask, what in your opinion is the most underused monster in a game of D&D or another fantasy role-playing game? What don't you see enough at the table?
Underused.
I want to say, I don't think flumps get enough. And I know Chaos, you're going to love this. Flumps don't get enough love, man. I know Taos has been banging that drum for years, and I'm on board.
The cuddly flumps, scary flumps, what flavor of flump?
Flump soup, any flump.
Any flump, flump any. Soup.
¿Por qué no los dos?
That's what you get as salvage if you slay a flump, is flump soup. Amy, how about you? What do you feel is an underused monster?
This changes for me all the time because, of course, obviously, everybody's home game is different where you're like, we haven't seen one of these in 8 years, and they're like, that's the entire. So my answer used to be like, I love bullywugs, but then Witchlight came out and it was like empires of all the delicious bullywug things that you could want. So hopefully we'll just keep knocking those off, but that for a long time I just find them delightful, you know.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I feel like we've got someone in the office who's just like bullywugs all the way. Every time he has an encounter, bullywug. That's the instant go-to is Nick's answer to anything. Dale Kingsmill, can I ask you, least used monster?
I think I've got the real true answer right now.
Okay, all right. Ettins. Sorry, you all were wrong.
I think Ettins are the forgotten child of the like giants family. I feel like a lot of the time when you have space for that kind of a baddie, the choice goes to something else. Even trolls kind of fit in that same sort of zone. I'll hit them with a troll instead.
Sure.
And so I love an end. Yeah. They're great. It's a classic.
And there's such a good story element
too.
Two heads arguing with each other. Exactly. You can reveal information to characters who, you know, are doing very, very well with their roles, with their perception roles, with just two heads arguing with each other. And you can have lots of fun with that. Even give the characters a chance to play one of the heads. That'll be even better.
That's actually a really good idea. I think anyone who played at my table, though, would say goblins.
Yeah.
I think they're one of the most common D&D monsters used out there. And no one has run into goblins in my world yet. I know where they are. No one's hit them yet.
I need sales players to get on it. I need to know the secret of the goblins that's not being discovered here.
Drill down, find out where those goblins are. I feel like I'd be more likely to use goblins these days with their sort of reframing as fey creatures, which I feel is actually like a step closer to original sort of hobgoblin and you know, that sort of
folkloric.
Exactly. That sort of stuff. All right. Because I said I would ask these questions, I've got a second short question that got buzzed to me through Hive. This is coming in from friend of the show, Gethin, wants to know, and this is very suitable for this week, what dragon is best dragon? Phil Beckwith.
Oh, I'm a sucker for a shadow dragon. Love a shadow dragon. Oh,
good answer.
Yeah.
That's a great answer. Dale Kingsmill.
I'm really stressed out now that I have to make this choice.
Do you need a minute?
No, because I feel in my heart that it's black dragon.
Why black dragon?
I don't have the answer. This is why I'm stressed, is because I just feel it. I feel that I love the black dragon the most of all the dragons, followed by blue. I don't know why. I don't have reasoning. I think if I was to be logical, it would be red dragon. But for me, it's black dragon.
No, I like that answer. I feel like we need to do, one day when we have time, a tier list of Dale's dragon based on gut instinct.
Yeah, I think I read like a short Pathfinder adventure once where there was a black dragon like under the water in this swamp that would come out and, yeah.
Cool.
I think that cool. just got into my imagination.
Great. Amy Dallin, your favorite dragon?
Which dragon is best dragon? I will say, and this is going to sound very company person of me, but like Fizban's, I loved very much the Treasure Dragon's sort of expansions to personalities, like the Moonstone Dragons as just the like, I'll trade you for a story. Like, it's just such a fun vibe, you know? It's delicious. But I also like the Emerald Dragons are sort of like, I like to collect interesting facts about people. This is all sort of candy for me. Yes, terrifying destructive power. Yes, distinctive lairs. But I like the personalities. They're just so fun.
Oh, I agree. I love that flip. I featured a brass dragon in one of my campaigns, kind of describing its scales as like a goldish red, so they weren't quite sure whether it was a red or what it was.
Yeah.
And terrifying, destroying, you know, villages and all sorts of things. Turns out he was being controlled by arcane magic. And which was just the most charming individual in the world. And I got that from the lore that's written in the Monster Manual, which says something like, brass dragons are so terrifyingly keen for conversation that they will like chase an adventurer and bury them in sand up to their neck until their need for conversation is fulfilled. And then they will let them go. And I loved that. Like, you know, the metallic dragons have like a malicious charm to them, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
Someone in chat has just pointed out that all of our answers were D&D dragons, and I didn't even consider the option for like Falcor or.
Yeah!
That's true. That's true.
Gorbash.
Best named dragon.
Smaug.
Pete's. Smaug, et cetera.
Mm. Yeah, Pete's.
Pete's.
Drogon. Yay, nay, no. Yay.
All right.
Wyvern or dragon.
What the hell? Get out of here.
Get out of here with your Drogon. Your Drogon and your Viseron. So they can. Pff, whatever.
That was such an immediate reaction. I'm so sorry.
Well, speaking of dragons, for once we have an excellent segue into talking about Dragonlance, which there has just been
you did
more
it,
and thank you. Yes, look, this is not my moment. This is Dragonlance's moment, so we won't dwell on it too much. But yes, more information seems to be being revealed and released and leaked little bits by little bits at a time. So we now have a table of contents for Dragonlance, which was shown online, and I don't have it in front of me, so I will be looking for that in a moment. Phil, you're a fan of Dragonlance. I've been trying to get a Dragonlance discussion going on this podcast for the last two episodes.
Right.
So we've pulled you and Amy in to talk all things Dragonlance.
Right.
Are you excited for this book?
I'm super excited. Amy, correct me if I'm wrong, but the pre-order release is dropping today, isn't it? Or tomorrow?
So tomorrow, when we're filming this, tomorrow the 22nd is when the early access period is going to start. For the folks who got that bundle of the physical and digital, that's going to unlock for Phil very, very soon. And for the general release is December 6th. But yeah, that means for some folks, it's almost here. Oh gosh.
I cannot wait. Yeah, I'm super excited for it. Super duper excited for it. I've had a look through the table of contents and I think somebody was flipping through their book and showing bits and pieces, and just getting me even more excited. And how I can incorporate it into my currently running Dragonlance campaign.
Currently running,
so you're gonna use it with your existing home Dragonlance game?
Yeah, that's right. So I've got a classic Dragonlance War of the Lance campaign that's been running for the last 3 years because it's tons of content, right? So I'm running through the original adventures at the moment for 5e, but so I'm going to be able to somehow, I've got ideas on how I'm going to bolt Shadows of the Dragon Queen onto it. So we'll
feels legit.
That yeah, no, so fun.
That grin right there.
Yeah, we were joking the other day. I mean, it's funny that he brought up Flumps at the start of the episode because we were joking that feels like the Dragonlance guy, like Taos, is the Flumps guy. Like,
wow, it's just not even
talks about Dragonlance very, very frequently. What I found interesting, so I have brought the table of contents up now, which has a couple of things on character creation. Obviously, the chapters, which kind of give you an idea of the arc of the adventure, plenty of friends and foes, which looks like it is probably a stat block chapter. I'm just going to presume at this point. Here's my question, right? Because this, I do have something that is known, is the Knights of Salamnia, the Mages of High Sorcery. These were backgrounds that we've been shown hints of. And a couple of episodes ago, when I tried to get a Dragonlance discussion going, we noted that there were prerequisites to using those backgrounds, which was that you should be or must be, if you take the prerequisite seriously, playing in a Dragonlance campaign. Which I thought was interesting because generally a lot of the way that D&D can be played is just like throw the kitchen sink, throw everything in there, anything and everything can be in that campaign world. And I've also noticed that the Peoples of Kryn in the character creation section is a fairly limited selection of the D&D multiverse peoples. Phil, I'm going to ask you this question. Looking, are these the typical Dragonlance races? Like, do tieflings not exist in this setting?
Not by old canon lore. No, they don't. Neither do orcs. Orcs don't exist in typical old school Kryn lore. But that's not to say that you can't have them in your campaign at all. Someone's going to pick me up for saying orcs aren't, because there was an orc at some point in it, and then. You know, there's like a million books.
Own it.
But, yeah, there's like all this canon lore. But typically it was, because you got to remember, Dragonlance, when it was first conceived, was like early 80s to mid 80s, right?
Right.
So tieflings weren't even a thing ever, really, at that point for D&D, especially as player races. But that's not to say that you can't bring them into your campaign. And I think even in the book itself, I think it's got some, like a little section where it talks about bringing this in. I know I saw some images of that page. So I think it definitely gives some advice on bringing those in. But
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the book seems to be doing a strong It seems to have a lot of intention about really creating the atmosphere of Kryn and the atmosphere of Dragonlance. By, you know, which is often the way that you can achieve that in a campaign is often by limiting player choices to, you know, the specific sets of peoples and cultures and places that are found within that world. And so I just, I found that an interesting thing that seems to be featured in the book as a way of kind of helping inform dungeon masters how to capture the atmosphere of Kryn.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a way to really get that original feel. I think it's a lot of fan service, to be honest. It's great that they've sort of come in and really set the boilerplate and then said, here, this is how you can bring all the other flavors into.
And we've also got Kenda there, which is nice. I'm assuming just from these chapter titles, and Amy, if you can't tell me, if you want to wait for fans to be able to open the book for themselves, that's totally fine. But I'm just going to make an assumption here. Looking at this table of contents, it looks like peoples of Kryn, we've got dwarves, elves, gnomes, humans is kind of the flavor text, what you should know about these peoples living within Kryn, whether it's the race options. Then we have Kenda, which I assume we know at this point is basically a new race, a new playable race.
I fully just 5e. Googled it. So
good,
no one
you.
At home feel bad if you also just had to Google it. I had forgotten.
Some of this I can definitely speak to, and some is sort of best for me to wait for, everyone to get to discover things on their own.
For sure.
You know, certainly like the confirming that the Kenda are a new playable option. That is something that hopefully we've done a good job of making sure people know. And if not, I'm so glad you're helping us out. There are some, you know, new backgrounds and feats and a new subclass and there is guidance on the way that the world works and how to sort of situate your character within it that is contained in those things. So I am very excited for folks to get full looks at that.
What is, Amy, is out there already, one of your favorite things for fans to dive deeper into? There was recently an article on the Death Dragon, I think it was called, which is probably going to be my favorite thing from Dragonlance. That thing looks absolutely amazing. Is there something that you're sort of excited for fans to dive into?
I guess folks who know me will know that I'm a terrible liar anyway, but like, just because I did a video on this doesn't mean I don't mean it. The Lunar Sorcerer is super fun. Like, the Lunar Sorcerer is really neat.
Yeah.
I hope folks, some folks may have had a chance to sort of test out versions of that as it was being developed. But it's a really cool subclass, which I love because it's going to have fun flavor in any world that you're in, but it's sort of especially fun in the setting of Kryn. I'm sort of cannot wait for all of the Phils of the world to sort of weigh in with like, all right, what is your specific version of that look like? Because it's just so neat given the mythology in Kryn and their multiple moons and association with deities, et cetera, et cetera. I'm very psyched for that. But I don't know. It's just nice to have one of the classic settings. Like, there are going to be so many... Watching D&D reach so many people that we kind of always wished it would reach growing up, it is, I think, a way that we can say that. Like, we wished that these rooms we were in had even more people in them to play with us. And it is delightful to watch some of that come to pass. And especially over these last few years, there would have been a time where it would have sounded strange to be like, Dragonlance is going to be new for a lot of people. But it is going to be new for a lot of people. And I'm so excited about that because it's got like, you know, some of my first friends who played games at all, like these were their screen names before I knew what like that setting meant, you know, they're like, oh, that's why you're Raceland. Got it. but it's not just those nice memories. It's coming for everyone. I'm sorry, y'all. I'm getting off track, but I'm excited. I'm really excited for this to be out in the world and for folks to start digging in.
I completely agree. And it's for people like me, right, who I'm useless when it comes to like actual D&D lore. It's a little bit funny I'm on this podcast, but I'm totally useless with actual lore. But it's when I encounter people like Phil. Hey, Phil, you're our example right now.
Yeah.
When I encounter people like Phil who actually have like that background of information and I get to have the benefit of both, ooh, this is a new exciting thing, and the Phils of the world telling me this is why I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
It just all pours in together and it's so much fun.
Oh, I forget. Yeah. We're D&D players. We like for things to have like a weird detailed backstory somebody developed for us that is nonetheless that's totally true. New to us. And that's what this is for a bunch of people who are going to be like, what a cool new setting. 40 years of history, you know?
Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I ran a homebrew campaign. I ended up losing out on having two players join the campaign, which was fine, but it was just because they couldn't read they couldn't go on a wiki site and just lose themselves in, you know, like you said, 20 years. 30 years of history in this setting and really work out where their character is from and how their childhood has informed how they grew up and how the culture that they grew up in has shaped them as a person to the point at which the adventure starts. And I'm like, yeah, that's fair. That's a very enjoyable kind of experience to have, is to go on those deep dives and really nut out where your character is from, even if it's only for you for the campaign, right? I'm a proponent of not sending your GM like a 6-page novella as your character's background, you know, maybe a couple paragraphs. But even if that is just for you to help inform your role play, I think having that stuff is really, really cool.
Just on the Moon Mages that you were talking about there, Amy, was I've now got this, because we've got a Wizard of High Sorcery in the current campaign. So now we're going to have to sort of, and we've had it going for like 3 odd years, right? So we've used some homebrew rules around how that works with the moons. So bringing the new rules in, we're going to have a really cool, sit down, me and that player, and try and figure out how we're going to shift across to the new rules. I'm really excited for that too.
Oh, yeah. I want the update once that's happened.
For sure.
The Wizards of High Sorcery, the most ancient, venerated, and fearsome of all the magical sorcerers of Kryn. Okay, great.
I mean, I really enjoy, I've said this on the podcast before, how those new backgrounds and feats are working to kind of create another aspect of the character that does really evolve along with the character to feel like your place in the world or your skill at your job rather than just your class is something that you keep getting better at. I hope to see more of that kind of in other settings. But you know, as you were saying before, Amy, the Moon Sorcerer seems like something, the Lunar Sorcerer seems like something that's pretty portable into other settings as well. And I think I've already heard of folks talking about using it in Tal'Dorei, where there's multiple moons and stuff going on with the moon. So it already feels like it's something that everybody can kind of sink their teeth into.
You know, I, not to just put Dale on the spot, but like the idea of magic being drawn from deities associated with the moon, there's some good history there. You don't have to dig that hard to get some good options going.
You're quite right. Right, Amy. But no, and it also, I mean, the really fun thing as well is that it, I mean, just to get a little mythological for a minute, is that it also lands you in some sort of pantheons and mythologies as influences that you maybe don't necessarily go to immediately otherwise, right? So like Artemis and Diana, is that the Roman? They aren't like necessarily the most associated with magic in Greek and Roman mythology, but once you get to Egyptian, once you get to Norse, you start getting a little bit more. And it's fun. It's nice getting little different influences.
For sure.
Absolutely.
A moon sorcerer that cross classes with cleric, maybe, or Oath of Ancients paladin. You can start getting some really fun thematic stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. So Shadow of the Dragon Queen releases, is it December 6th, I believe, is when the full release to the public is going live. So if you are a Dragonlance fan or wish to become one, get on it. Speaking of Wizards of the Coast, last week we had a bit of an extended discussion based on some rumor mongering that happened on the internet around how the OGL and the SRD will function with the upcoming release of 1D&D, which is still a few years away. I'm just going to pull up. Wizards have since released a statement on that. I'm just going to read that statement out quickly. And basically, they've said, we will continue to support the thousands of creators making third-party D&D content with the release of 1D&D in 2024. While it is certain our open game license, OGL, will continue to evolve just as it has since its inception, we're too early in the development of 1D&D to give more specifics on the OGL or system reference document at this time. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see what future things 1D&D holds. I will continue to do so with bated breath. Speaking of bated breath, some people's breath gets bated when they're heading to visit family because they're excited. And a lot of folks, may be visiting family at this time, particularly in the United States where Thanksgiving is happening this week. Amy, I believe you brought this discussion to us. I think it's a great discussion to have about sort of introducing Dungeons and Dragons, or not even D&D, maybe, you know, tabletop role-playing games, or maybe even just board games to family members during times of togetherness. Dale, I remember you talking about introducing your mum to D&D.
Yeah.
Or she said she wanted to try it.
Yeah. So this was, I liked it because you've talked about, you know, playing with young family members and running for sort of the kids in your family. I have kind of the opposite experience where the younger the family member, the harder it is to get them to play D&D. But no, my mum, when she was a teenager, got a copy of D&D for her birthday and never played it. Ooh. Just because we are not a mathematical sort right. of lineage. And so it was a little bit, you know, difficult to pass. And I remember having a conversation with her. And I don't know, I don't know anymore whether she played me or I played her, but we had a conversation about how she'd always wanted to play D&D. And so as a result, no matter which direction it was in, the seed was planted. And I knew that we were kind of in a stage of life where we, you know, if we couldn't think of something to put on the TV, we'd sit down, we'd play a board game or whatever. And so I immediately after that conversation went and created just a bunch. I created like 10 different pre-gen characters with different interesting concepts, with a couple different options that I thought each family member might be interested in playing, and waited for the next time someone said, "Hey, what should we do tonight? I don't know, maybe we should play a game." And I was like, "What about D&D?" Slapped my pre-gens down on the table. And we did. We played D&D. I had this this one-shot prepped, and it was a heavy hack of Hollow's Last Hope, which is a Pathfinder game, but we were playing it with 5e for starters, and I changed the entire storyline. But, you know, that's just how I do. So no, it was just kind of very spontaneous of the moment. Let's play D&D. And it was a really, really enjoyable evening. My dad's first ever roll of a D20 was a nat 20.
Nice.
It was, he called his ranger Ford because he thought the pun Ford Ranger was incredibly funny.
Very Hitchhikers. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And no, it was a great time. I really, really enjoyed it. We ended up playing it over a couple of different sessions. I think two different sessions, just sort of 1 week and then the next week. And no, I hope everyone had a good time. Certainly meant that Mum asked to play again at some point, and we did that as well, which I've told that story on this podcast where she did create an evil cleric who at the end of the adventure did convince sort of the town Gaston type character that in order to get the treasure from the dragon horde, he had to walk to the bottom of a frozen lake. So he drowned. And I was like, okay, I see. We're getting into true D&D player territory. So no, it was delightful. I think part of it as well is that there's almost, I think, more difficulty trying to schedule a D&D game with your family than with your friends almost. But when you have a holiday like this, when there's a lot of people around and there's a lot of free time, it's amazing how quickly people will be like, yeah, sure, that sounds fun. And they can fall in love with it so fast and so easily. It's just such a delight to see it happen.
Yeah,
for sure.
It is a beautiful story. I have to, okay. So I love that you're like, it was a beautiful spontaneous a evening for which I had prepped a one shot and made 10 free gins that I had in my back pocket. Yep. Did the people go for the ones you thought they would when you were like, things I thought would be appealing, or did they nab surprise choices?
My mom definitely did. She went straight for the sort of fey warlock. I'd pitched them as sort of a Faustian character who'd made a deal for knowledge, and I knew that that would be something Mum might be interested in, and so she went straight for that. I think Dad did surprise me a little bit. The ranger character that I'd prepped was a little bit more just sort of a standard filler character for if nothing else piqued anyone's interest. I think my sister went for one as well. I think I got it pretty much on the head, the nail on the head there, trying to pitch ideas to them. I was very chuffed with myself.
Have any of them gone on to create characters after the fact?
Yeah. So my sister, I think that might have been the first time that she played D&D. I'm not sure, but Shannon definitely sort of went on. And I think she was a little underwhelmed with the character that I'd built. I think there was a little bit of disconnect between what I pitched the character as and how the mechanics worked, which was on me. But afterwards, that just drove her to go and make characters that were more exactly the fit that she wanted. So
yeah, gotcha. Yeah. I have a theory, and I'm curious to know if your family kind of fit this, or for other folks who have introduced their family members to D&D, is that most people, when they make their first character or they pick their first pre-gen, generally pick the character they think they want to play, and it's kind of someone that's relatively close to themselves, maybe, or someone that they relate to from they've seen in, you know, Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or whatever it happens to be. And then the second character that they make, once they really know how character creation works and they're sort of a bit unshackled, is the character that they really want to play. And it's nothing like the first character they played whatsoever. The first character I played was like a paladin of the forest, who was like this very stoic, very good, you know, gentleman who wanted the best out of everyone. Very kind of like Legolas crossed with Aragorn, I suppose. And then the second character I played was just this gregarious knight who, you know, was very loud and basically based on Darren DePaul's Reinhardt voice. And it was great. It was great fun and completely different to what I thought I would want to play initially. Amy, how have you gone with playing D&D with your family? Are they generally into the hobby as well?
Most of my family is nerds, but it was not in all sort of different forms. So I have not gotten every member playing D&D yet. They come from different sort of, like, you know, math nerd, history nerd, like sci-fi nerd. Gathering them all together has not happened. But we did get a nice, this was sort of on my mind because some of my siblings, we were able to sort of put together a couple of games on recent family things, as we've discovered that, like, exactly like Dale said, sometimes you're like, this is the perfect moment for a board game or for, you know, brief sit down. It's very, very fun to see that different side of folks, especially like if you've got, you know, cousins or step siblings or other sort of like icebreaker-y, your brother and sister you can play D&D with already because you've already been playing silly imagination games with them basically since you were born. But like you get different flavors of that with different levels of family, whether it's kids or parents or aunts and uncles. Which is all just to say, I really love it. It's very fun to do family D&D. You see different sides of it than you do from sort of your like specialty nerd friends. And they come up with great surprises. And I have to give credit, like my big sister has, I think we all started learning around the same time. My brother and I were in elementary school. My sister, I think junior high, when we all kind of discovered D&D. But like, you know, I grew up on the stories of like her college campaigns. And like the, you know, which is nothing sounds cooler than your older sibling's D&D game.
That's how I got into tabletop RPGs. My brother was playing with his friends and I was like, this sounds, I don't get it, but it sounds like something special.
So I can't give credit for pulling her into D&D games, but we have pulled in other family members around us as we go. And man, it's just a blast. It will also make you realize everything you don't know how to explain will come up when you are trying to be like, oh, yeah, right. I do need to remember how to make prepared spells sound like a really simple concept. Hold on. Mm. Do you know what an iPod is? You know, like, they're on there. You get this many plays. The battery dies. That's making sense. Okay. It's you get fun challenges that way is all I'm saying with your family because they aren't sort of like going to humor you. They're just going to be like, that doesn't make any sense. Try again.
We picked a good episode to have three Australians on because Thanksgiving just means nothing to us. you know, generally around the holiday periods, you know, whether it's Christmas, Thanksgiving, even like things like Halloween or, you know, Easter, times when you get the opportunity to gather with your family. Do any of you have like almost family traditions where every so often you'll play a game of D&D because it's like, okay, yeah, Amy's coming. Yeah, great. We're going to run D&D because Amy's the D&D member of the family.
No, I would love that.
Well, I'm quite lucky. My lovely wife is actually part of our regular weekly D&D campaign. So it's really easy for us. And then the kids now see us playing weekly. So my son has just recently come to me and said, Dad, can you teach me D&D? So I've just sat down with him probably 2 weeks ago, and we just did the first little part of Stormwreck Isle, and he loved it. And now he's like, when can we play again? I'm like, on the holidays, mate.
The scheduling right after the Joy of Discovery.
Yeah. Right there. You got to teach him young.
Had the whole experience already. It's great.
There's an Australian comedy band. This is for Amy and all the listeners who aren't Australian, right, called Tripod. And they once did a musical about D&D. And there's a song that they play at the very end of the show that is just about one of the members, his real life experience as a D&D nerd. And it makes me cry every single time, but it's like, you're a nerd, you're being bullied, but you've got D&D and that's good for you. And guess what? You're going to grow up and you're going to become a bard, is kind of the crux of the song. And it makes me weep. But there's this sort of bridge in the song where he's talking about, you're going to have a daughter and you're going to give her first set of dice and she's going to play D&D too. And it's just cue balling every time. My heart, the family legacy is so beautiful.
We'll have to get an office game going, Phil, because I know that we've got a couple of sort of ghostfire family members who we should get into play D&D at some point.
The work family.
Work family, thank you. Were you like, when your son first came to you, were you like, well, let me introduce you to Dragonlance. Now you're going to need to know.
Last night we actually started watching the Dragonlance cartoon, and I know it's a rough watch, but he loves
it. There's a cartoon?
There's a cartoon of the first novel that was written for Dragonlance, yeah.
When did it first come out?
That cartoon movie came out around 2008, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's way more recent than I thought. For some reason, I was assuming like...
Tell from the animation style. Like, it looked like 80s animation with some weird stuff happening as well. But it's a fun watch. It's D&D cartoon, so sure.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool to slip into the alternate dimension where we all grew up on like the Rankin Bass Dragonlance adaptation or something like that? That would be very cool.
Well, speaking of things that are cool, there is just a tiny little bit of news that I hadn't gotten to yet this week. And I just think this is cool for a very specific reason. I believe WizKids kind of gave a sneak peek at some extra bits and pieces that they have coming tied to the D&D movie, Honor Among Thieves, including some miniatures, which include an owlbear, a displacer beast, a mimic, a gelatinous cube, and a question mark. They're leaving the last one as a mysterious...
It's missing, no.
Yeah. I'd love if it was. That would be fantastic. But they've also, I don't believe this is WizKids actually, this is another company, but there's a company that is producing plushies of the owlbear, the displacer beast, the red dragon, the mimic, and the gelatinous cube.
The gelatinous cube would be a great plushie.
This is the reason I brought this up. It is an amazing plushie because it's basically a plushie box and you can open it and pull out all the bones and equipment from the adventurer that got dissolved inside of the gelatinous cube.
Wow.
It is incredible.
So when I was in high school, we did a production of The Lieutenant of Inishmore, which is an Irish play. It's a black comedy. Anyway, but at some point, there's a dead cat in the play. Look, let's just skip through the storyline. But for this production,
how does this relate to a plushie?
I'm getting there. I promise it's valid.
I am forgiven for every segue I have ever made.
This is an anecdote, not a segue. All right. Segues are... Give me a minute.
Yeah. Cool story, Ben. Anyway,
I'm wrapping background.
I was in Les Mis when I was younger, and I played Chauvet.
So for this scene that we were doing, I had to have a cat that I was going to kill in the scene. And so I got a toy cat, like a plush cat, and I cut off its head and made it so that it would attach with Velcro and I could rip off the head. And then I thought, you know what? I could go further than this. And so I filled it with a spine. I stayed up all night watching the Alf movie of all things, making a spine for this cat and little organs that I could pull out and throw at people during the scene. So I'm just saying, I'm excited to see that being made official.
Is that people Alf like to eat cats?
What's that? Sorry, Phil.
Is that because Alf liked to eat cats?
It was not a choice. It was just on television. It got very late. I was at the whims of the programming.
Did you have to run the cat prop plan by anyone, or were you like surprise cat pieces?
I don't know if I had to, but I certainly didn't. yeah.
Cool. Cool. Okay. Well, now you don't need to stay up late watching Alf because you'll have your own little bones and things that you can pull and they glow in the dark. So perfect for stage theater.
Now I want to know what Martin McDonagh would do with a gelatinous cube story, though. And that's a thought I'll never be able to unhave. Thank you.
I think the only person I would trust to write that, frankly.
The perfect thing which decays slowly inside is the old ideals you have left behind. And some filthy words, probably, is what...
Okay, all right, moving along.
Sorry, I'm very sorry.
No, that's great. Look, I love a bit of theatre history as much as the next person. Welcome, we've got a couple of people first time... chatters dropping into chat, so welcome. We also, speaking of the audience, have some emails. If you have an email that you want to ask the podcast, you can email podcast@ghostfiregaming.com and I will present them to our panel here to discuss. The first question coming in, we were talking, I think, a week or two ago about third-party supplements. And so somebody has asked, what is your favorite non-D&D specific supplement that you use as a source of inspiration? Last week we had Gabe Hicks on talking about the Session Zero system, which I think will probably go on to be one of my favorite non-D&D supplements to incorporate into my game. But what are your folks? What are some things that you use that kind of influence your game?
One of my favorite things is, I think it was made by Gnome Stew a long while ago. It's called Eureka, and it's essentially like 100 adventure plot ideas in a book for all different genres, and you could literally just roll on it and there you go, you've got an adventure idea and you can just build an adventure from there. I use it all the time when I'm adventure writing. I'll seed an idea, then I'll build something bigger out of it, or just when I'm just need something to run for people and just go, well, look, that's a cool idea, let's go with that. It's fantastic. I definitely suggest people run out there and have a look at it and grab it. It'll be available from somewhere, probably Amazon or something.
It'll be out there somewhere. You can catch somewhere. One in the wild.
Right.
You can find it. Google exists. Use it. That's Phil's advice.
It's so good, though. So useful.
I don't know whether it's a good habit or a bad habit. I use stuff that is not supplemental material as supplemental material. So I use the fiasco sort of relationship generation for D&D, or I use the sort of character town building stuff from Kids on Bikes for D&D, or it's very in the style of Abria Iyengar recently for Dimension 20 running A Court of Fae and Flowers with More Geek and Sundry Vlogs alumni. Hey, Omar, how's it going? But you know, she used the Story Brewers. What is that game
good
called?
Society.
Good Society. Use the Good Society sort of epistolary phase where you write letters throughout that to really great effect. So I kind of am in that vein where I, rather than using supplemental stuff, will largely go and just rip things wholesale from other games and shove them in where I want.
You know, I'm trying to think what I would use, and I'm like, even just like people that create books of maps. I know that is something that's kind of become popular, or people that have Patreons that create maps that, you know, are probably intended for use with 5e, but, you know, aren't necessarily that.
Anything, yeah.
But even so like good. Board games that have miniatures, like just physical components, you know, like I will create stat blocks based on a miniature from a board game that I have, or I'll buy big Kickstarter board games to get, you know, all right, that's got like 10 skeletons and 10 zombies and it's got this I don't know what that is, but I'm going to terrify my players really, with it.
Again, my brother's Lizard Man Army.
Yeah, exactly.
Plus, he got the Dark Souls board game. I'm using those minis all the time.
And they're beautiful as well. There's any of those miniatures, like the Dark Souls or the just the creature design is like really off kilter because like their werewolves from the Bloodborne board game look really stretched out and just kind of odd in a really impressive way. And is it Tainted Grail? I don't have a copy of it. I think that's what it's called. I don't have a copy of it, or Shattered Grail, Broken Grail, something like that. Someone in the comments will correct me. And their monsters just look so off kilter. They're just so strange, you know. They're not like an ogre and a dragon or whatever. I mean, those are great monsters as well. But it's like this thing, I don't know, it kind of looks like the King in Yellow. It's like floating and it's just like nothing but cloak and it's got some bone crown thing going on it as well. I don't know. Let's come up with rules for this.
I know that I love a lot of different games, and I feel like to sort of Dale's point earlier, I think it is difficult not to sort of steal little bits and pieces for yourself from every game you've ever loved, where you're like, I loved how it felt to do this, felt to do this angle on this, or like the deep dive into this setting of like, you know, this ice world in Star Trek has given me some tropes that I might use for all ice worlds forever, you know. But I do, I also, I don't know if this is a cheater answer because it's not sort of a like, go out and buy this, but like I, you know, I steal from comic books. I steal from like other things where it often sort of under cross-pollinated where you're sort of like, here's a really cool monster because Daniel Warren Johnson just drew something with too many spines. Like that looks like it could belong. And classic literature, this is, all right, this is going to sound really silly because this is one of those, I've discovered that books get famous for a reason. but like I had never read Three Musketeers. And the original Three Musketeers has an extensive section where the main characters can't afford the stuff they need to go do their thing. There is an actual section that's like, we are too broke to buy our gear to go be cool musketeers. And here's what we're going to do about it. And it's each of them has these different like mini storylines of how they're getting the money to buy their gear. And I was reading this just being like, they solved the problem of making this dramatic hundreds of years ago. And I just didn't know about it. But all of this, like, we need to go shopping. How will we get money for our stuff? Can be done in a thrilling adventure story. And it's already been done. It's in this book. I mean, that one's a sort of a comedy adventure where one person's answer is, you know, the person that you seduced to bankroll you. Like that's, but as we all know, that is occasionally a way that a tabletop RPG player might go about solving some problems. So that's my advice, is the tremendously obvious, take just the most famous books in the world that for some reason you never actually looked at and realize that they are full of TTRPG advice.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. I'm going to use the Colville advice. I know I quote Colville as much as Ben quotes The Witcher, but just saying, take what you love and put it in your game.
Colville Corner.
Yeah, the Witcher Watch Colville Corner, exactly. Take what you love, put it in your game.
Yep. Yes, I agree. I saw in the comments, they were like, he hasn't mentioned The Witcher yet. He's still got it. How much longer have we got left? Okay, he might be able to mention The Witcher.
I got worried. I had to bring it up. You'd be like a mermaid without water.
Yes. Definitely steal from video games. They're a great source if you're a video game player. I was joking. I've just started playing God of War Ragnarok. No spoilies, thank you. La, 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 la. Please genuinely keep spoilers out of the chat. I was joking that I need a new God of War watch. We just did a video on the YouTube channel this week, Gone, where I created Kratos' weapons as magic items for D&D from that game. And it's just, you know, even games like Mass Effect or Batman Arkham or, you know, God of War. I'm trying to think, there was a fifth game that I had in my head because I made a buzz about it earlier today talking about my favorite video games. But yeah, you can grab story structure, quest structure, monster hunt structure, magic items, NPC ideas. You know, it's all kind of fully realized for you there and then can bring that into your D&D game by adapting it. So it is fertile ground.
Like volcanic soil.
It is what? Sorry, I missed that.
It was so not important that I don't want to repeat it.
All right, cool. All right, I'll let that go. You get off on this one, Dale. All right, moving on to our last question of this episode of the Lorecast, which comes in from Nick, who emailed this in. And Nick wants to know, I feel a bit seen at the moment because Nick's PCs just reached level 7. After 5 years of playing the game, they have just reached level 7. Now, important context was left out of Nick's email, which was how regularly they play, whether they're actually a weekly campaign or whether it's monthly or once every so often.
Did they only play twice?
Exactly. So
maybe
Nick
they're leveling very fast.
They could be. Well, this was the thing, actually. This was kind of tied into his email. He had two questions, which was like, what's the longest you've ever let your PCs stay at certain levels? How long does it take you to level them up generally? And tied into that second question was, after 5 years in real world time of playing, only about 3 months have passed in the game time. And I'm in a similar situation in my campaign at the moment where we've been playing for maybe 6 months, but I need to keep going back through my adventure journal, reading the in-game dates that I've put on certain sessions to figure and make references in game going, ah, yes, when you visited such and such a week ago from like 3 months earlier, just to remind the play, give them context to the conversations that they're having. And all of this really wraps into a conversation, I think, around pacing. How do you pace your campaigns in terms of leveling, keeping in-world time, making sure that it's staying interesting, making sure that time is relevant, all those things. Have I spent too long asking this question? Yes. Amy, go.
Oh, it's a great question, though. And it's tough because there are a lot of different answers. There were games where sort of building in a gap between each session makes a ton of sense. And that's sort of, it's easy to move the calendar forward that way. But then especially the more you're playing out sort of like exciting, dramatic situations, the more you want to know the exact next step. And okay, I'm going to say a piece of information that may or may not be accurate. So please correct me if it's not. But the story, I believe, that comes down is one of the books of Game of Thrones was supposed to be a big time jump. And George R. R. Martin, when he got close to it, was like, I don't want to skip this stuff that I said was going to happen in between books. I want to tell it. But essentially, the original planned structure was very much changed by the fact that rather than jumping to the end of that and being like, here's all the stuff that happened, here's the next piece, it sort of plows straight forward through in this way that like telescopes out, you know, how much time everything is taking. And that's how you can get that many books in or that many sessions in. And you're like, it's been a week and a half. But it was such a dramatic week and a half that we could not bring ourselves to skip something. I feel like there are points where you have to kind of break your own heart and be like, we are agreeing that a time skip happens so that we will all like, so that the players will begin to catch up to where we, or so the characters will catch up to where we, the players are in terms of we have known each other for a long time, in terms of we've been on a bunch of adventures, because there are points where you're like, we're ready to be like our characters would die for each other. But in game, we met 3 days ago, you know, that, and you want to kind of feel that. Ideally, you can feel out that tension and be like, all right, we have to sort of like get to this next decent stopping point and decide. And at some point, we will let ourselves be like, and several months pass. Here's what we were doing during that time. Like, I think you just got to force the time break in. In terms of exactly like what barometer to go by, I mean, I do like to revisit the sort of, oh, it's either the PHB or the DMG that has your basic, you could go every couple of sessions. Here are a few different takes on how to, like, I like to go back and be like, what do we say in the books about this? Because usually I find I am surprised to realize there's already a paragraph in there that I forgot existed. It's like, here's three different ways to do it, you know.
Yeah.
I've never gone 7 years or 5 years getting to level 7.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a long gap. I have been in games where I feel like it goes too quickly, where it's like if I'm leveling at every single session, I'm like, I'm not bored of the old toys yet. I don't need new toys yet. So I like to, you know, especially at first you can go pretty quickly, but I like to spend a good chunk of time, but never quite that much in my experience.
So for our 3 year, 3.5 year now, the characters are just gotten to level 10, right? So it's a bit of a churner.
Okay, just how frequently do you play?
We play, it's a weekly game. We did have about 3 months off earlier this year, but it's generally a weekly
game. Pulling up a calculator.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like working this out against Nick's game. And
we need to know where you rank on the, because we usually make fun of Ben for taking forever to level people, but you might have to be the person we make fun of.
There's been absolute tragedy in my campaign.
I'm
going to
assume you take weeks off for Christmas as well. I'm going to be.
Of course, right. Yeah. So we do it by, we milestone level for starters. So that's, and then, you know, the adventures, especially old school Dragonlance adventures, can last a while. Some of them are quick, some of them just very much open to roam around and run into adventure. And who am I to say no to the characters wanting to go visit somewhere for another side quest adventure? Who am I to say no? Jumping on to what Amy was saying was, and this is something that I think is that the One Ring does really well, is adventuring seasons. So they have like an adventuring phase, and it's generally around like the warmer months, and winter you lock yourself down, and during that time that you can time jump to the next season, the next year, and you can sort of go through years of in world time to really bring about sort of the passing of time and really age your characters that way. And then you can start looking as the characters get old enough, you can start looking at bringing in, you know, the next generation of characters and legacy and things like that. And also between adventuring seasons is it's a really good time to give the option for downtime as well. I think downtime's a really good way to show in a high level view the passing of time through different things that you've done during the non-adventuring time.
I feel like I need to reframe downtime in my head, because I am the George R. R. Martin where I don't take downtime. I don't take breaks, sure. You know. Every day is chronicled in our campaign in somewhat detail, unless they're traveling between locations, in which case it's like 10 days go by or like a week goes by while you travel between locations. But it still feels very like days of our lives, every day is chronicled rather than actual downtime, because generally not much happens whilst traveling, unless you run into something, in which case it becomes just more of the adventure. And every time I read, like reading the advice for downtime in Xanathar's, it was like, what could you do during downtime? And it's like, do a heist where you go to an auction and you steal an item. And I'm like, that's not downtime. That's not relaxing. That's an adventure. How is that downtime? I feel like I need to like
have a beach episode, Ben.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's what I need.
But then you just want to play the beach episode.
That's true. Exactly. You do want to play the beach episode.
Exactly.
I feel like, I mean, I've been banging my drum on this podcast about how I've made the change to short form campaigns. I don't need to worry about it. All the pacing's baked in. There's only 8 sessions, baby. that's sort of a deal. And I've also mentioned before that I like to level people up when I see them demonstrating uses of their previous level stuff in game. You know, so if my bard player is not using inspiration, then I probably shouldn't start adding more stuff to their tool belt. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But if I'm working with more experienced players, then clearly they've already got this thing. And then I wait until we've beaten some reasonably sized boss and then everyone levels up, you know? Yeah. But this is where Amy is my safety net. Now I'm putting you on the spot. All this conversation is making me, it's making me think of, this is my funnest fact about Marvel Comics. So... In Marvel Comics, the timeline works in this really specific, peculiar way, right? Measured from a very specific point, I think it might be around the time that the Fantastic Four was first being published, they decided that in order to have time pass ordinarily, like, you know, it's Christmas time when it's Christmas time, so you can publish your Christmas comics, but also so that they wouldn't have all the characters, you know, get really old really fast, they did this thing where they condense time every 4 years. So as time passes, everything's happening in real time for 4 years. And then once you hit the 4-year mark, it all gets condensed into last year. So they'll refer to the events that happened in those 4 years as happening last year. And so that's how you end up with Spider-Man being, you know, like middle-aged instead of, you know, old. And it's this really bizarre, interesting thing that they just decided to do at some point and they stuck to. And there have been comics where, you know, characters have ventured into an alternate universe where time moves linearly like it does in the real world. And so, you know, Ben Grimm is ancient. Like, it's all this bizarre stuff. And I can't help but think, wouldn't it be really interesting to do something like that with D&D, where it's really just like, we'll treat it as though it's the real sort of passage of time, but every month the real world time will condense it. We'll just say, yeah, that was last month. I think that would be fun.
Fascinating. I feel like the thing you're describing with Marvel sort of condensing time along a thing, there definitely, and there could have also been more than one of this, so I might be thinking of a slightly different one, but like there definitely was a point where they were sort of like maybe early 2000s or something, where like Mark Waid or somebody was sort of like, here's kind of the vision, here's how we're making it work, and here's roughly the math that makes that make sense. Like, I think it's like many things with comics canon, it is something which has at one point been true. Does it remain true? In what form? For how much? It gets a little squibbly. But like, you know, the part of the idea at one point being like, all right, this is how we're going to solve this problem is fascinating. But to your point, Dale, what a great idea for like D&D multiverse shenanigans of like the one where it really has been 3 years in these three days, like, which to my going right back to comics, this was the idea behind the original Earth 1, Earth 2 split for DC. I don't know if I have comic nerds on the talk. If someone in chat hears me, but
they get
so very long story, very slightly less long. DC is Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. And they like those characters had been continuously published from their introduction circa World War II into the revival of superheroes in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, called the Silver Age. But they were sort of like, all right, how do we deal with the fact that we have a new Flash, but Superman's been around forever. And the answer was, we ignore that. Everybody's friends and they're the same age. But somebody came along and was sort of like, what if the World War II heroes just kept aging? And like, they were getting older and a new generation came in. And so the other Earth, they actually got older. Like, and so when the two Earths started meeting each other, there was like generation gap issues where it was sort of like, oh, you have a grown up next generation is coming in as you're aging out, while we just decided to go with the we stay the same forever. So they did actually meet each other and have these sort of encounters. And it's a great idea, is all I'm saying. Dale, you're a genius.
I love that. That makes me very happy. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that we love, I'm sure everybody loves this podcast and will be very happy to know we'll be back next week. But unfortunately, we have to bring this episode to a close. If you want to get in touch with us, email podcast@ghostfiregaming.com and I will bring your questions, much like I did with Nick and Derek, to our panel. You can also comment if you're watching this on YouTube down below. And I can sometimes I bring those up. Or ask me a question on Buzz. Send me a Buzz on Hive, sorry. On Buzz. Whatever.
You got too close to the sun.
I just became that gif of Matt
Your
Damon aging.
Your hubris has found you.
just shriveling up before your eyes. Great. All right. Anyway, moving on past that embarrassment. Amy, where can folks find you? Maybe on Hive if they want to follow you.
I think you can find me on Hive, actually. I believe I managed to sign up. There's at least one post there. I am EnthusiAmy everywhere, or you can find me over at D&D Beyond, talking about Dungeons & Dragons goodness for Wizards of the Coast, where I help make videos to share the exciting things coming. And I just, this was such a treat. Thank you. I obviously lost track of time and had 10 answers for every question, but that was because this was too delightful, and just what a lovely time. Thank you.
Thank you for making the time. And of course, Phil Beckwith, folks can find you as well on Twitter, I believe, at this point.
And they can buzz me as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's growing.
They can buzz me as well. I'm Phil Beckwith, D&D everywhere. So just look for me there.
Perfect.
And if I'm there, well,
Make sure to like this if you're watching it on YouTube. Leave a star rating if you're listening to it on Spotify or somewhere else. And come back next week because we'll be back with another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. I've been Ben Byrne, here with Dale Kingsmill, Phil Beckwith, Amy Dallin, and we will be back next week. See you then. Goodbye. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Friends.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Good night.